Hello and welcome to episode 155 of the Palestine Pod, the podcast where we break down the latest headlines dealing with Palestine from all over the world and bring you stories, commentary, and interviews with the aim of supporting the Palestinian struggle for decolonization, justice, and equal rights. I'm one of your hosts, Lara E. You might know me from Instagram as @GazanGirl, and I'm joined by my co-host, Mikey B.
Hey, what's up, y'all? Mikey B on TikTok. I got kicked off Instagram. And you can call me Mikey Intifada if you've been found in the Epstein files.
Hey, actually, we should probably start giving our upscrolls on the pod. Since
I am
Mikey B
back. No, Mikey B on upscrolled.
Okay, great. Same. GazanGirl on upscrolled, same as Instagram. And we're going to hopefully try to start using upscrolled. It's been difficult to transition. I like, even though most people are getting on it, people haven't fully replaced it with Instagram yet, but I do think it's, you know, it's coming. So before we get into today's episode, please like, comment, subscribe. If you hang out with us on YouTube, if you're listening on a podcast app, subscribe and leave a review. As always, you can find our full episodes on palestinepod.com. And if you want to get involved in the conversation, reach out to us at palestinepod@gmail.com. Give us a follow on Instagram, also @thepalestinepod. You can also find us on Patreon, where you get early access to the Palestine Pod episodes and an additional podcast per week. It's called the Patreon Pod. It's a little more laid back. We talk politics, Palestine, pop culture, and get a little more personal. We're also hosting our monthly Zoom happy hours with our Patreon subscribers only. So check us out on patreon.com/palestinepod. Today's guest is Dr. Mimi Said. She has been to Gaza a number of times on medical trips, humanitarian trips during the Palestinian genocide. And recently she was banned by Israel, along with several other doctors, from re-entering Gaza to provide support and care and treatment to the Palestinian families there. She's been an outspoken advocate in support of Palestinians during this ongoing genocide. And we are so pleased to have her on the Palestine Pod. Dr. Mimi, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You have been absolutely tireless in your advocacy, speaking up in every venue that allows you to share your stories on what's happened in Gaza, what you've witnessed. Maybe just start by telling our viewers about when you went to Gaza, where you were working when you were there, and what you witnessed.
Yeah, I was there in 2024. That was my first time there in August. I stayed there for a month, August 8th until September 5th. And at that time, I was at Nasser Hospital, and I stayed inside the hospital at that whole time. So we don't really leave the hospital. We stay inside. And, you know, that entire month was just mass casualty after mass casualty every single day. The number of patients that I saw was just something I wasn't prepared for. It's not even just the number of patients. It was the type of patients that I saw. Something that I didn't quite grasp the gravity of it until I was there on the ground seeing it. And it was immediately. It was the first day I got there, the first hour I got there. There were children, you know, brought in by people, laid on the ground, dead, most of them. And it's just something that I never thought in my life I would see injuries like that.
Yeah, give us a sense of, you know, what it was like to provide care in those moments, because we know you're also up against the fact that Israel had severely, if not almost totally, restricted the entrance of humanitarian aid. You yourself have spoken about how you were unable to bring in medical equipment or medications or materials with you. And so it's almost like you have all this experience and this knowledge, but you don't even have the tools really to be able to provide the care. So what are you doing in those moments when you receive a mass casualty and, you know, you have dozens and dozens of children, family members, people all living in the same apartment building that are arriving, and then you have to try to treat them with very limited supplies?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question, right? Do you think before, like as a physician, I thought, okay, I'm going to go there. I'm going to save lives. I'm going to make a difference. But it's, you know, and we do save lives. You know, there are many children I talked about that I helped treat. But the problem is that there is nothing there, right? Even basic things people don't realize, like clean water, soap, gloves, gauze. These are just basic things that we don't even think about in the U.S. or any other place for that matter. But before I went, I was told, you know, you should bring a couple things with you because we don't have that here. And some of those things were like hand soap, a pair of gloves or a box of gloves. and also something called a laryngoscope. So a laryngoscope is something that in my practice as an ER physician, you know, we need that for that initial step in stabilizing someone to save their life. It's the airway protection, right? And it's a small kind of, it fits in your hand, and there's different sizes. There's one for adults. There's a size for children, different sizes for based on how big the child is. But I had a bunch of those kind of donated to me, and they're disposable. So I was going to take in like dozens of these in my suitcase. I had medical supplies like medications with me, you know, different things for surgical surgeries that people needed. And I was told before I even went in that I'm not going to be allowed to take that in, that the Israeli government prevents all of those things from entering Gaza. So if it's not for your own use, you can't take it in. So basically the things I need to practice and do my job to save lives, I can't take in. But still, I managed to kind of smuggle, you know, a couple in. I took one adult size and one child size, and I hid it in the corners of my luggage. And luckily, I wasn't searched that first time at all. I wasn't searched, you know, and they didn't take those laryngoscopes away. But I took one box of gloves with me, disposable gloves. And I thought, oh, well, I'm sure the NGO I'm going with is going to be able to bring in some supplies and some gloves. Well, I was almost out of those gloves in like the first few days. So what I had to do was use the same pair of gloves for one day. So if you see 100 of, you know, say 100 patients in a day, and you have blood and fluids and all these things, I would literally put my hands on this, you know, on different patients in the same pair of gloves and just rinse it with dirty water in between or the soap that I had. I mean, I did that day in and day out. So there was, you know, those are the basic things. So forget about the more important things like antibiotics and pain medications, sedation. We were doing procedures like amputations. You know, a baby, I remember documenting all of these things, but a baby that came in at Nasser Hospital during a mass casualty incident, you know, a baby in diapers still. And we had to revise that amputation, cut off the part that was bleeding because the OR was busy and no medications given. I had a pair of scissors, trauma shears, in my tackle bag. And I remember taking it out and just cutting off the rest of this leg of this baby. And I mean, it's hard to articulate in words the feeling that you have, but also the reason why it's happening and why it's necessary, completely unnecessary. So it's one thing to be in an area where it's impoverished and, you know, you just don't have the supplies or you can't. But this is being deliberately blocked. I could have brought stuff in. You know, these pain medications could have been brought in, but it's just not. It's not allowed in. And so, you know, you asked about my role, and it was a hard pill to swallow. When I first entered Gaza, I had this notion that we're going to do a lot of good, we're going to help, and we do. But really, when you're there, you realize that your job is not. It's actually not just medical. You're witnessing, you're showing up in solidarity, you're documenting, because these are crimes that you're witnessing. And very soon you realize that your job is much bigger. And I did. It took me a couple of days, but I did. And I remember having that conversation with my husband. You know, I said, I don't think I can do meaningful work here as a doctor. But I think that my role has to change. You know, I took that to heart, and most of us do.
I think that's an important observation, because what we have witnessed during the genocide is that Israel has targeted Palestinian journalists in mass, killing hundreds of them. And so all the information that we were able to get is despite the fact that Palestine's journalists in Gaza were being targeted systematically, and that Israel succeeded in killing hundreds of Palestinian journalists who would have otherwise continued to bring us stories every single day. And so now you emerge as a witness to, as you said, these crimes against humanity, to an ongoing genocide, to the attempted eradication of an entire people. And suddenly you have to advocate, document be a voice for and a witness to these crimes in the hopes that eventually there will be accountability. So that dual role, I think, that you identified is something that I've heard a lot of other physicians who went to Gaza speak to. We had Dr. Mohammed Subeh on the show, and we also had Dr. Mark Perlmutter, the hand surgeon who also went to Gaza. And so, and then you and I were also on the Gaza Tribunal with Dr. Thaer Ahmed, who also went to Gaza. And so this type of witnessing, you know, I think has been shared by a lot of the physicians who go there. I can't imagine how you're emotionally dealing with some of the ways that you had to treat these patients and the walls that you have to put up in your brain in order to be able to do the work that you're doing and then continue to get up every day and advocate for it. I mean, it must be a tremendous mental and emotional and psychological exercise. But so I wonder if you could speak a little bit to some of the emotional aspects involved of, you know, being a physician in these contexts, especially since a lot of the time these children are arriving to the hospital without their families. So who's taking care of them? Who's feeding them? Who's making sure that they find their families? Do some not ever find their families, even if they are survivors and, you know, their families may have also survived? I mean, what is that whole process like in the hospital? Is it just pure chaos? Is there some systems in place that are trying to reunite families with one another? And what was your role in that?
So, you know, Gaza Strip is very small. Everyone pretty much knows everyone. Like, you will find one degree of separation from most people. So it's very small. So if the family was alive, they would find each other. But, you know, like you said, there's a lot of orphans. There's a lot of children that come in that don't have family because they've been killed or separated somehow. The great thing about the people in Gaza, the Palestinians, is that children don't, you know, someone will take care of them. Someone will become their next family. And I never saw kids that, you know, that were wandering. I did see many children wandering by themselves, but eventually someone takes care of them, whether it's a neighbor, whether it's a distant relative. So they have somebody. Now, unfortunately, they do walk around because of the situation. They are walking around unsupervised. I remember seeing many children like that walking around with just empty containers, you know, with the hopes that they'll find food or water or something like that. I saw that both times when I was there. But when these kids would come in, you know, there's, like I said before, there's only so much you can do. And the emotional struggle, I don't really feel I have a right to talk about my trauma because it's nothing. It is absolutely nothing compared to the people in Palestine. You know, in Gaza, the healthcare workers, they have to see this day in and day out. They don't really get a break. Or they don't have the luxury of looking away or taking a, you know, a social media break or something like that. The mothers, the fathers, the brothers, the sisters, that they have to see this all the time. Other children, you know, see other children that are beheaded with traumatic amputation. That's just not normal. You're not ever supposed to do that in your entire life, you know, a child witnessing that. So who am I to talk about my trauma? Of course, anybody with any amount of like normal intelligence or emotional intelligence is going to have trauma after they see and witness something like that. It changes you forever. I will never be the same person again. There is no getting over it. You know, you don't just simply get over it and accept it. I can't. I know most of my colleagues can't. So what do I do to, you know, to cope with it? Is I do what I'm doing. I advocate. I continue to advocate. I look to the Palestinians for strength. I talk to my friends and the people I met there on a regular basis. And they are my source of strength. And ironically, you know, they're the ones that need our help and they are my source of strength.
You had a lot of experience going on interviews from mainstream media to independent media sources in the aftermath of your going to Gaza. And I'm sure that you were confronted, at least in some cases, with the remark that the death toll of the so-called Hamas Ministry of Health cannot be trusted. This is something that came up over and over and over again. It was one of these tactics that was used by mainstream media to downplay the ongoing genocide, to deny it in real time, to sow doubt in what we were witnessing as a people all over the world who were seeing this streamed in real time, and to try to get us to not believe the images and the videos that we were seeing. And so I just wonder how You feel now that the Israeli occupation forces have finally accepted the casualty number that was provided by the Palestinian Ministry of Health, keeping in mind that there are so many other estimates that put the number in the hundreds of thousands, if not more.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really need, you know, the Israeli officials to accept it or not accept it. That's kind of like a slap in the face. I don't think anybody really cares whether they accept it or not. We witnessed it. I saw patients, you know, when the Ministry of Health actually counts patients as part of the death toll, they are so careful when they're trying to report it that they're underreporting it. And we saw this regularly, right? They're so careful because they don't want to say, unless it's absolutely certain, they don't want to say that this was, you know, a death related to the military conflict. Because they want that source of credibility. And they are so careful about it that they end up underreporting it. And I believe it was, you know, estimated to be underreported by 40%, but I think it's much higher. Getting to the hospital by itself is it's very difficult. You're not going to go to the hospital just so you can be counted, or you're not going to take your family member to the morgue just so they can be counted. You know, people are in there under the rubble. People are in areas that are difficult to access. They can't get to the hospital. You know? So if their loved one dies, they probably just get buried there. So they're not always being, they're not coming in with the, you know, just so the Ministry of Health can say, okay, this is another one to put in our death toll. So then that number is severely underreported. Actually, Dr. Sidwa, Feroz Sidwa, he just did a very thorough analysis and wrote on the Zatea website about specifically this, the death toll. And it's worth checking out. It's long, but it's, I think it's a three-part series or something, but I was just skimming it the other day. You know, and the Lancet also published, you know, quite some time ago, that this number is very underreported. And at that time, it was much less than 71,000. You know, I really don't care what the Israelis say. They have a very poor track record anyway of being held, first of all, being held accountable for their actions, but also of lying and just blatantly fabricating things. So I don't think, you know, and if you had any sense of intelligence, you would know that that doesn't really matter.
Yeah, it was actually during the Biden administration when Biden was trying to cast aspersions on the death toll, when the UN had to come out and say, oh, no, the Palestinians are very honest about their death toll. We've never had a reason to doubt them. And so that was, you know, during a Democratic administration.
Yeah. Yeah, and they also say they don't target civilians, but they drop bunker bombs on families in tents living in a humanitarian zone. And I witnessed that firsthand. So, you know, I'm sorry, I don't really have much to say about that other than I don't really care whether they accept it or not.
So I was reading reports and media that you've done, and you were one of many doctors to confirm that you saw at least 18 children during your time with gunshots to the head or chest. And I'm just wondering, have you ever seen anything like that in the medical profession before?
Yeah, I've reported on that extensively since I've returned. So the first time that when I was there, I saw like one or two, and I thought, I saw children with gunshot wounds. And I'm like, okay, this got to be crossfire, right? Like this happens in conflict zones, I guess that happens. But I saw it every day, and I saw multiple cases of this in one shot. So when we're, you know, ER physicians do something called a fast exam with ultrasound just to see quickly to assess at bedside whether someone has other injuries, like internal bleeding. You know, with bombs, you have barotrauma inside the body. So we would regularly scan all patients coming in regardless of their injury. And none of these children that I documented had other injuries. They had a single shot, either a through and through or retained bullet. And I documented 18 cases of those, but there were many more that I couldn't document, obviously, because I was also practicing and, you know, doing medicine at the time. But I had, you know, a medical student that was with me that would record often with my phone as well. So all of the things that I documented, it was on my personal iPhone. So I can't say, or anyone can't say, well, you probably got that picture from somewhere. But what's interesting is, when I came back, you know, the New York Times op-ed that Dr. Sidwa wrote, he polled a bunch of us American healthcare workers, I believe it's 99. And about 65 of them said that they saw children with gunshot wounds, to the head or to the neck or to the chest. And when I came back, I hadn't realized that there were so many other people. I hadn't realized it. But I had photos of children, CT scans of children with bullets in their head and in their neck. And so they asked for photos when they were asking us to complete this poll. And I submitted these photos along with others. But they ended up publishing three photos. And all of those photos are ones that I took of patients that I had. And they were all CT scans. And I'm sure you guys have seen it because those photos, you know, were talked about quite a bit. But what I didn't expect was other physicians and other professionals to accuse me of fabricating those images. I was, you know, and X is like the most toxic place. So suddenly everyone became like a ballistics expert and radiology expert. Like, oh, this is impossible. You can't possibly have a bullet that's retained in a head. That doesn't happen. Well, anyone that's treated kids or people with gunshot wounds knows that happens all the time. Now, I'm born and raised in Chicago. Like I said, I trained in Chicago. I lived in Chicago and I worked as an attending there. Gunshot wounds are not foreign to me. I have seen many patients with gunshot wounds. And what I saw were gunshot wounds. And I have seen bullets retained. And, you know, each time when I saw some of these kids that came in, we would ask, what happened? Where were you? And many times, almost always, they said it was a quadcopter. A quadcopter had shot their kid. And so that was something that I took, you know, when we went to DC to talk to lawmakers, to policymakers, I showed this photo. I showed a photo of Mira, the little girl that I talk about, you know, with a bullet retained in her head. And I was met with like skepticism or indifference, like, oh, well, we know this happens. I can't do anything about it. Yeah, okay. You know, well, let me see. That doesn't really look like that's possible. You know, so those type of reactions, and it's just something that, to me, I don't know, you can call me naive, but I didn't think that I would be met with those types of reactions. And I've said many times on interviews, I've said, you know, it's not like a gray area. It's black and white. You don't shoot children, period. That's full stop. If a child came into my emergency department in the US with any kind of gunshot wound, forget the head, law enforcement would be in my hospital asking questions, trying to figure out how it happened, even if it was an accident. Something would happen, accountability would be had. In Gaza, even in the West Bank, it happens all the time. It's a normalized thing because it's so common. You know, and what I didn't expect the most was death threats. I've actually gotten so many death threats because I have shown this picture. I have talked about it. I talk about it all the time. Anytime I'm interviewed, I talk about children that were shot that I saw. And I've gotten people calling my work. You know, I had someone call my cell phone telling me they're going to send a pager to my home because I was a Hamas sympathizer. I was a terrorist sympathizer. And so it's ridiculous. It just shows you that this is, that saying that children deserve to live, they don't deserve to be targeted, is something that's so triggering for people. And it should make people think, why?
There was this moment, I think, towards the beginning of the genocide where a lot of people felt if we just share what's happening, then surely we can stop this. If we can just show everyone that they're targeting children, that, you know, people's senses will tell them that this has to stop. And I think over the last weeks, as we've seen the release of all these documents relating to the Jeffrey Epstein scandal, that a lot of us have had to come to terms with the fact that, incidentally, the torture of children, the killing of children, does not affect people in the same way or in the way that you would think. So for decent people, it's something that enrages us and makes us, you know, moves us to action. But there are people in this world for whom the same cannot be said. And so when you were meeting with these lawmakers who were indifferent about what you were sharing with them, when, you know, in the hearts and minds of any decent human being, that should, you know, enrage them, you know, beyond belief. I think it's something that we have to grapple with as we continue our advocacy. Like, not everyone cares in the same way. And in fact, for some people, this is actually a source of pleasure for them. It's a source of, like, what, you know what I mean? So it's it's something that I think we haven't really grappled with yet as a movement, you know, in terms of how do we deal with this, that, you know, you're going to these lawmakers and you're thinking, if I just show them, well, then surely they'll do something. They'll vote differently because we all agree that targeting children is bad. Well, in fact, they don't care.
I don't know why we're expecting pedophile rapists to like advocate for justice, right? Like, these people are not aligned with justice. And I think that many people are figuring that out now. But like, many of these people are incentivized. Many of these people are making money off of this. Many of these people are just twisted individuals who can't be reasoned with. And so, yeah, I think that's something that we as a movement have to grapple with.
It's also, you know, it's very apparent, like the Rafah border just opened, right? Or you know, opened. Israel has absolutely no interest in helping Palestinians in Gaza. I mean, specifically Gaza. I mean, Palestinians in general, but specifically Gaza. They don't care to have humanitarian aid come in. They, you know, 50 patients were supposed to leave every day, right? Since the border opened. And it's been a fraction. And in a couple of, for 2 days, there was absolutely no one going through. There's about 20,000 patients waiting for medical evacuation. And I think about 15% have made it out this year. So it's, or not this year, 2025. So nobody, you know, everyone thinks, oh yeah, like the border is opening and there's also a ceasefire. And, you know, do you know, like, the food that's been allowed in so far since ceasefire? It's been junk food. Do you think it's nutrient dense food that patients need, that children need to develop? No. And this is so deliberate, though. That's the thing about this, is that it's so insidious. You know, why would you allow cigarettes and iPhones and junk food in when you could allow protein sources, you can allow nutrient dense food for children that need it for their developing brains and bodies? They don't.
This, because they're committing a genocide, right? So, and exactly. And the weaponization of humanitarian aid has been one of the key methods of carrying out the genocide. It's also related to what we saw when Israel banned dozens and dozens of legacy humanitarian organizations from operating in Gaza after its relentless attacks on UNRWA and dismantling the entire UNRWA structure, essentially in Gaza, preventing it from operating, banning, and then saying that, you know, they were going to end operations for UNRWA in Gaza. They did the same with dozens and dozens of other humanitarian organizations, banning their operations in Gaza. They put pressure on humanitarian organizations like Doctors Without Borders to turn over lists of Palestinians working with them. And initially, Doctors Without Borders was going to comply, and then they reversed their decision. And so the way that Israel has used humanitarian aid, the withholding of it, the ensuring that the entire structure essentially collapses, that has been one of the central means of carrying out this genocide. And it continues to be. And, you know, as I think what you touched on with the so-called opening of the Rafah border, the so-called ceasefire, I think is also really important, because once there's this narrative that things have died down, that the mainstream media and discourse can attach to, then we see that the crimes are essentially continuing, but a completely invisible fashion, right? Mm-hmm. So in the last couple of days, Israel can kill over 20 Palestinians in Gaza and it won't get any attention. Nobody will talk about it at all, right? And that's because there's a supposed ceasefire. That's because they'll focus on the fact that, oh, the so-called Rafah, you know, border crossing has opened, and so Palestinians can now leave. When in reality, what we know is that Palestinians are being prevented from returning to Gaza. Those who are in Egypt and are trying to go back are being prevented from returning in violation of their right to self-determination on their land and their right to return. We see that Israel is encouraging Palestinians to leave through the crossing, and that those who actually desperately need the medical care are not even being allowed to leave for medical treatment, thereby further frustrating and making it essentially impossible for them to recover and live. So the genocide is very much still ongoing. And I think as we see, like, the next steps, this so-called Board of Peace that Trump now has established, the proposed plans for it, which were unveiled, the latest plans of which were unveiled at the World Economic Forum, with Kushner standing there pointing to a map of Gaza, these concentration camps where Palestinians are supposed to live amidst these industrial zones, like an Elon Musk industrial zone and other areas, including AI data centers. I mean, what a completely dystopian model we have, and one that must be resisted completely, because if it is not, then that becomes the blueprint for future societies. You can kill everybody, and then you can rebuild on top of them an essential, you know, a community where wealth is extracted, where people's rights are oppressed, where they're surveilled all the time. And this is what Israel now stands to get away with. And if it does, then the rest, you know, this model comes to us.
I think that model was perpetuated by the United States, right?
Oh, yeah.
And is being continued. It's continued. The policy is being continued through the occupation of Palestine. And I think that, like, what we're seeing with the treatment of children is exactly how Black children were treated on slave plantations. And so this is something that is not new to Turtle Island. This is not something that is new to American society. There's a lot of people who are having this, like, oh, this is an us moment, but that's like a very liberal interpretation of the settler colony that they've been a part of their entire life, right? And so I think it is important to acknowledge, like, all of the things that we've seen in Gaza have happened on, you know, Turtle Island in the United States.
Like, you don't always need bombs to kill people, right? From a medical perspective, the things that are happening in Gaza are, it's difficult to appreciate those things from like social media, if you're like just scrolling or even just mainstream media, because they don't cover it. But you don't really appreciate it until you see it with your own two eyes. And that's something that, you know, people don't realize, is the land, the agricultural land is completely destroyed there. It's poisoned by all the bombs and the munition. And so people can't grow their own food, right? So for the future, this is affecting, you know, decades later, this is the future. People can't grow their own food. People in Gaza were very good at growing and sustaining their own food. Now everything is controlled by Israel. So every piece of food, every morsel of food that enters Gaza is because Israel, you know, allowed it in. So you have to think to yourself, they're relying completely on Israel to give them the nutrients that they need, that their future population needs. So the children that are being born, they're being born into severe malnutrition, malnourishment. That's not something that's fixed like overnight, right? And that's affecting the future. That's affecting a population's future. So it's crippling it. But this is the type of kind of insidious aspects of all this, because we see bombs, we see, you know, guns shooting and everything, and that's very distracting. But what people don't realize are the very implicit parts of all of this, and taking away education, you know, for children, disrupting it for the last 3 years. So those are just things that I think are just so, they are so significant, that this is so clearly genocide, because they want to affect the future, you know, generations to come in Gaza.
That reminds me of one of the contributions to the Gaza Tribunal by actually a former guest of the Palestine Pod, Hala Hanina, who spoke about the reproductive consequences of the genocide and the ways in which the Palestinian population has been suppressed through reproductive means, the targeting of fertility clinics, the essential bombing of thousands of embryos in one go, and the increase in miscarriages, infant death due to the inability to be sustained and have healthy conditions for a pregnancy and taking care of an infant. So that contribution, I think, was really powerful. So you guys can check that out on the Gaza Tribunal's page on YouTube. One thing I wanted to mention in response to the indirect or sort of like more quiet consequences of the genocide is that we've already seen this happen in the life expectancy, right? This has already showed. We've seen, you know, months into the genocide, it be documented that the life expectancy in Gaza has gone down by half, right? So now if you are born in Gaza, you can aspire to live to the age of 40 years old, whereas before it was well over 70, right? And that, I think, is the biggest proof of the genocidal conditions that have been put into place in the last 2 years. you cut the life expectancy in half. People do not aspire to live long and full lives in Gaza because the conditions that Israel has created ensure a premature death.
Absolutely.
And I think another important, let's say, takeaway from all of this is that we need to reset the conversation. You know, we can't keep talking about Israel must let in, you know, this amount of humanitarian aid. There needs to be full freedom so that Palestinians don't even have to be in a discussion with what aid Israel is going to allow into their land, right? So much of the discourse, I think, is defensive in that we're constantly responding to the conditions that Israel creates and saying, no, Israel has to do this. Israel has to allow Palestinians to live a little bit better. Right. Israel, you know, and it's like, actually, we need to back all the way up to the very first violations, the grave violations of international law that have been unaddressed for over 77 years. Palestinians have the right to return to their homes, to take back their property, their land, the wealth that was taken from them. They have the right to be free on all of their land, not only in Gaza, but in the land that was stolen in 1948. And so much of the discourse right now is about trying to improve the conditions for living within the concentration camp of Gaza, which is ever shrinking. And I think that is not the right way to look at this. We need to remember that everything that Israel is doing now to Palestinians in Gaza, it already did to Palestinians in other parts of Palestine 77 years ago. And that this is just the latest phase of pushing Palestinians out of their land and ensuring that Israel can take over their land and expand and continue to expand. I saw yesterday on X Israeli families that were walking towards Gaza to begin to settle it. Of course, totally illegal. It's an illegal occupation. They have no claim or right to this land, but it's happening before our eyes as it already happened before in other parts of Palestine. And so it's important to remember the whole story and the continuity of the expulsion. It didn't begin with Gaza. And if there is no accountability, it won't end with Gaza.
Imagine how ridiculous it is too, though. Like, I was just thinking, imagine during World War II, if Germany was put as part of the peace board, you know, like, it's crazy to me how Netanyahu's on the peace board. This is a war criminal that has caused the genocide happening right now in Gaza, and he has been appointed on the peace board. Does that make any sense? Am I crazy? Like, I don't understand. I don't get that part.
No, he should be on the cutting board, actually.
Yes. And I'm saying, like, the country that's the perpetrator is responsible for providing the humanitarian aid. What incentive do they have to do that? Makes no sense to me.
The same people who bragged about putting the people of Gaza on a diet many years ago and controlling their calorie count before they destroyed 90% of their civil infrastructure, those people are not the people to be trusted. And Lara, what you're talking about, revolutionary politics. We can't be constantly on the back foot reacting to them. We have to address the core issue. And for that, everybody should read Mao Zedong and Ho Chi Minh and draw your own conclusions.
Yeah, I want to turn to Dr. Mimi in the time we have left. I think we have like 10 minutes left or so. You were recently banned by Israel from going back to Gaza to provide life-saving care. And we all know why you were banned, because you were making an impact in defending against the genocide that they are carrying out. And so therefore, in order for their genocide to be more successful, people going to Gaza to save lives like you have to be banned. I know that you have tried to challenge this through the Israeli court system. Obviously, there's no expectation that the ban will be reversed because you're up against a court system that is completely complicit in the aims of the government's genocidal policies. But can you speak a little bit about what is going on with your attempts to challenge it? And then also, like, what your plans are going forward in terms of how you continue to support Palestine and Gaza?
Yeah, I think, you know, their whole reasoning for banning people, it's so, there's just never a reason given. And you're left to speculate, because it isn't always people like myself who have spoken up. You know, I have seen healthcare workers who have absolutely no social media presence, who haven't said anything about what they saw there, and they still get banned. So you're kind of left to speculate as to why. It does seem very suspicious, because, you know, myself and other colleagues who have been very vocal, which many of us have, we have been banned from entering. Yes, I did appeal it. We didn't hear anything back the first round. So I'm not hopeful that I'll be allowed back in, but I just don't feel that it's fair to just allow them with impunity to do whatever they please. I don't think that, you know, I'm a security threat when the past two times that I was allowed to enter, it was just fine. And suddenly now I'm a security threat. So that doesn't make any sense. Not allowing people like myself who have the life-saving skills, who have, you know, actually even know the system now because I've been there twice. I know people there. So it's easier for us to actually go and work rather than someone who's going for the first time. It's even better for someone like myself to go back. So there's just no reason why we should.
I mean, that's if you're trying to save lives, but your assumption that they want to save more lives, I think, is not correct.
Well, exactly. And that's for people, that's what people should understand, right? But yeah, I mean, I think we continue to be banned. It didn't stop. You know, more people have been banned since then. And it just so happens, like, after the second or third visit in, that's when you do usually, that's the kind of pattern that we've seen, is that's when you get banned. I think that it needs to be challenged, whether they respond or they don't respond, who knows? I know that others have appealed and they've gotten in, but I think I just don't feel like it's okay to just let them do that, because I'm an American physician. I've even gone to my own state government and said, you know, this has happened to me. I would like your advocacy in allowing me and helping me. And others have done the same to their own state officials, but, you know, obviously it just never goes anywhere, just like everything else that we've tried to appeal and talk about. Yeah. And as far as your question about, you know, what I plan to continue doing is just what I am. And I've written several articles that hopefully will be published coming up, but, you know, just continue to talk about it. Anyone who lets me talk about it, I will talk about it and I won't stop. But I think that that's about the only thing we can do right now, right? Even people, if you're not a physician and you haven't gone to Gaza, people ask a lot, what can we do? And it's just, don't be complacent. Don't be okay with what's happening around you. And like you were saying, you know, as far as revolution or systemic change, I think that this is, you know, the first time in my life where I thought, okay, the system has to completely change. And it is so connected, right? This film that we were in, the Seeds for Liberation movie, it does such a good job at talking about that, at the collective liberation, the collective issues that we all have. I think that's one of the mistakes that we all make, is I see people separating the issues. I see them saying, well, that's doesn't have anything to do with me. That's, you know, that's over there in the Middle East. That's not here. I have to care about the immigration stuff happening here, not the stuff in the Middle East. Well, that's the thing. It's connected. It's all connected. You know, how ICE is treating people now is just a fraction of what the Palestinians go through, what the IDF does to them on a daily basis. But it's the same playbook, right? The same exact playbook. So I think that that's the thing that people need to do, is wake up and see the connection, connect the dots, and everything is affected. Everything affects you. Something happening to someone in the Middle East absolutely, you know, is relevant to you here in the United States.
Same methodology, same technologies that are shared to surveil, same types of weaponry. Same people, actually. Michael, you spoke about how there are some people who were actually in the Israeli occupation forces that come back to the U.S. and now have joined ICE. So to say that, you know, the liberation is intertwined, I think, is really an understatement in that context of state repression. But I totally agree with you. And I think, you know, that it's important for us to keep that in mind so that we can develop cohesive strategies to resist this type of oppression, whether it be in Palestine, whether it be in Turtle Island, whether it be elsewhere in the world. I remember seeing a headline about how after 2 years of war, countries are now interested in procuring the weaponry that was used by Israel in Gaza because it has been battle tested. And that was in the Washington Post recently. And I kept thinking, man, Palestinians have been telling the world this for years now. We've been telling the world for years that Palestine was the testing ground for technology that was going to be used to surveil and kill people all around the world. And now the Washington Post has said it plainly, right? Mm-hmm. It's something that, again, we've been saying forever, but now it's just, you know, it's just out in the open. It's part of the mainstream. And it's said in such a way that it shouldn't, you know, almost as not to trigger any reaction. But of course, like, this is exactly what we should be resisting.
The ideas being segmented, fragmented, the movement being fractured in that way, I believe is a psychological operation by the CIA, because I saw a video of a CIA officer admitting that the biggest thing that the CIA is responsible for is weaponized cognitive dissonance.
Yeah, like, cognitive dissonance in the United States is, that's our middle name. You know, that's exactly what we do here in the United States.
Yeah, so you get people to subscribe to these various identities, like sports teams or, you know, celebrities, whatever. And you get them to exert their energy there as opposed to confronting the systems that create the conditions that we all live in, where we're ruled by a bunch of like rapist, baby-eating pedophiles.
And that's not an exaggeration. That's not even a joke. Like, that's not even...
You know what's crazy?
That's a literal...
How many people owe me an apology? That's what's crazy. Is I've been saying this for years. Anyways.
I know. I saw so many good memes about and reels about people saying, like, I, you know, welcome your apologies.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I'm starting with everybody.
Dr. Mimi, I want to thank you for joining us today and continuing to speak up about the genocide that you witnessed in Gaza. Your advocacy has been very inspiring. You're very calm and clear-headed, and always look to you as a source of information for what is happening in Gaza. So thank you so much for all that you have done and all you will continue to do.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, all right. We're so happy to have you. Thank you so much for your efforts.
Thank you.